My topic is identity politics in the 21st century, a Kenyan perspective. I must say that this is the same topic that I presented, as Dr. Granis has said, in Berlin yesterday. So I hope that I did a good rehearsal for the presentation here, and that therefore it will go smoothly. And I'd like to first share my outline. I'll be giving a background, then I'll be introducing you to the Kenyan ethnic groups, just in case you don't know about them. And if you do know about them, you'll bear with us so that those who don't know can hear about that. Then we'll talk about the aspirations of Kenyan ethnic minorities. We'll then talk about politicized ethnicity, which is also called ethnicized politics. And finally, we'll talk about the inadequacy of liberal democracy in the Kenyan context. What I hope to do is to touch on all these subtopics, and whichever one then catches your interest, we can pursue further in the open discussion that will follow this. Forgive my computer for talking, but that's the only way I get to know what's on it. So I am a person with total visual disability, as you have already noticed. So let's go to the background. Now, identity politics, as I understand it, refers to the struggle for state power based on the interests of a relatively stable group in a larger society. In other words, for me, politics is always about capturing power, state power, for that matter. And then, in the liberal tradition, the individual is the most basic unit in the political process. The individual is it. He or she is the one who makes decisions according to his or her interests and votes accordingly. But in the last few decades, maybe really not very few decades, we have had a situation where stable groups are demanding recognition as groups. We have the feminist movement, we have the disability movement, which I belong to, we have, of course, the environmental movement, and we have ethnic-based movements. And they are saying we want to be recognized as entities, the way in which liberal democracy recognizes individuals. We want to be recognized as a body corporate and to be given space in the political arena to make our case and to pursue our aspirations. And this is what I refer to as identity politics. And in the Kenyan context, and largely in the African context, the most dominant strain or brand of identity politics is ethnic. Ethnic groups competing for power. And so I'll be talking about that for in a while. So I'm saying in sub-Saharan Africa, identity politics can be traced back to the 19th century partition of Africa. I'm sure you're familiar with the partition of Africa, when Britain, France, and Germany met in Berlin, where I was yesterday, and decided to split up Africa like a pie. You will have that piece, and you have that piece. And that was the beginning of mighty social disruption in Africa. And I'll be talking more about that. Now, the politicization of ethnicity quickly became one of the most intractable problems in independent Kenya. Once Kenya got its independence, competition based on ethnicity, political competition based on ethnicity became a a very, very prominent feature of our politics. And in fact, the way I listen to the Western media, they give the impression if only those Africans could stop this tribal thing, they would all be fine. Incidentally, we reject the use of the term tribe on us, because a tribe, as I understand it, is a savage, backward, violent bunch of human beings led by a chief. And if you have read Lord of the Flies, is a book by, I think he's William Golding. At one point when their democracy breaks down, they form themselves into tribes. the boys in that particular novel. And each of them has a chief, and they fight each other. Well, that's not how we are. And incidentally, the whole politics of whether we'll use tribe or ethnic group is a long one, but we shall be getting back there. Now, I would like to state at the outset that I work in the area of political philosophy. This is a work in political philosophy. The essential nature of the task of political philosophers is to take what is known about human societies and the ways in which they are governed, and then to ask what the best form of government would be in the light of aims and values that they believe their audience will share. In other words, political philosophy is distinct from political science. Political science is part of the social sciences, and their main interest is facts and figures. But political philosophy focuses mainly on values, standards by which to judge whether a political system is worthwhile or worthless. And that is where I focus my reflections. I'm not a political scientist. Now, you might know that in the middle of the last century, some people declared the death of political philosophy. They decided that since political science has come to its own, there is no longer any use for political philosophy. But then came the work of John Rawls, A Theory of Justice, among other works, and such works breathed new life into political philosophy. And so that is my approach. Obviously, the political philosopher benefits from the research of the political scientist, because a political philosopher does not go to the field. He does not use the empirical approach. If he did that, he would lose his identity. And we are talking about identity. What is it that distinguishes you from someone else? And then in the political arena, that is made a big thing, and then we have real trouble. I think I'm a Kenyan, and we belong to the country of the marathon. And therefore, what has happened is that my slides have jumped by one. I will sort it out and tell them they are out of order, because the gun has not yet been shot for the race. Now, slide five. Among the questions that political philosophy asks are the following. Does it really make a difference to our lives what kind of government we have? Do we have any choice in the matter? Or is the form of our government something over which we have no control? Can we know what makes one form of government better than another? Those are some of the questions that we reflect on in political philosophy. And I come to you based on this particular orientation. Now, Kenyan ethnic groups introduced. The official number of Kenyan ethnic groups is 42. However, this number was arrived at in an arbitrary manner by the British colonialists. Why do I say that? Because some of the groups we call tribes today are actually, call them tribes, that's what they call them, are actually clusters of ethnic groups. The groups that we call ethnic groups, like the Luhya are actually several ethnic groups, I believe 16 of them, lumped together by the British and told, hey, you are all Luhya, right? And then the politicians in that cluster of ethnic groups decide, it's not a bad idea. We will then have more numbers if we cluster together. The Kalenjin, I believe, are 8 groups combined together, different ones, and brought together under the umbrella Kalenjin. Then you have the Mijikenda, who are actually 9 different groups, but they were told they all belong together. And so when you are counting, and you're saying there are 42, you are counting 16 as 1, you are counting 8 as 1, you are counting 9 as 1, and that's why this number is arbitrary. So, the next point that I then make here is that this number is arbitrary. There are 5 ethnic groups with considerable numerical strength, and that often form political alliances that can hope to capture state power. These 5 groups, the Kikuyu, the Luhya, the Kalenjin, the Kamba, and who have I left out?
The Luos.
Oh, that's very good. I left my own people out. And the Luos. At least that encourages me that I'm not too selfish. Now, these 5 can win elections through alliances. The rest of the groups can therefore be termed as ethnic minorities because there are so many, but they are only 14% of the population. Even if they combine all of them, they would lose elections. And they do not have a strong bargaining chip going by their numbers, so they are easy to ignore. The bigger ethnic groups ignore them easily. Consequently, Kenya is a multi-ethnic state, not a nation state. You know, we always talk about nations. And people come to me and ask me, is that a Kenyan song? And I wonder, what do you mean a Kenyan song? Kenya as an identity is a colonial construction. Because before 1895, there were human beings in Kenya. There were political organizations in Kenya, what we now call Kenya. But they were not using the term Kenya, and they were not together as one political entity. They were not Kenya, in fact. They were Giriamas and Digos and Luos and Kikuyus and all manner, but not Kenya. Then in 1895, the British begin to set up their rule on 1st July 1895 through a proclamation. And at the coast, they get a lease of that so-called 10-mile strip from the Sultan of Zanzibar. And they call that the Protectorate. Later they go inland as they are building the Uganda Railway. And as they build the Uganda Railway, Kenya is just a path to Uganda. It's nothing more than a path to Uganda. But as they pass through, they suddenly realize, hey, there are nice lands just after Nairobi. Lovely lands that produce plums and peaches and pears. And they decide these are the White Islands. And so they decide we better make this region a colony. And in 1920, they declare it the Kenya colony. Therefore, Kenya as an identity is a very new thing. I was talking in Berlin to relatively young people, and when I told them Kenya is a very, very recent concept, it is officially a term that comes into serious use from 1920. So it's a very young thing, less than 100 years old. And some of them are thinking 100 years old is young. And I'm saying culturally that is very little time. Because culture takes time to take root. And if you asked my grandmother, in Luo we call her Dana. Here you call her Oma. So Oma, Dana, are you a Kenyan or a Luo? She will certainly tell you she's a Luo. Not a Kenyan. She'll actually wonder, how can you even ask that question? I'm a Luo, of course. But now in the public space, all the time, the story is, let's not bother about our different ethnicity. We are all Kenyans. And when you do that, you don't solve the problem, because there is even no problem. It is you causing the problem. The problem is when we deny our cultural diversity, because denying our cultural diversity has been brought about by politicians who use the ethnic card to gain power and pretend not to use it. They use it, pretend not to use it. Now, then, in the Western environment, when you talk about ethnic minorities, you are usually talking about people, groups that have tiny numbers in a state. And in fact, according to one scholar called Shermerhorn, that group must have less than 50% of the population. It must constitute less than 50%. So Shermerhorn would say, there are no minorities in Kenya because there is no single ethnic group which has 50% and above. The largest group, the Kikuyu, have about, is it 22%? And that is not nothing near 50. So, no minority politics in Kenya. Majority, minority. But we disagree. We disagree because the five big ethnic groups can form alliances and win elections. The many others, over 30, can never win elections even if they cluster together. They must try to cluster with one of the big five. So these others, in that sense, in the Kenyan context, are actually minorities. Slide 7. Now I want us to look at aspirations of Kenyan ethnic minorities. What do they want? Well, you have the agitation for federalism by a number of ethnic minorities. As Kenya was getting her independence in 1963, there were two main parties, KANU, which was the party of the Luos and the Kikuyus together, and KADU, which had a lot of the smaller communities, Kalenjin and the Luhya and the Kostians. And these were supported by the settlers, the European settlers, who also felt they needed to support the minorities, so because in the process they will have protected their own interests, because they too were minorities. And they agitated for federalism. But KANU, Kenya African National Union, with the Kikuyus and Luos, who were the biggest communities then, the Luo population has been dwindling, I'm told, but at least I'm here, I have not dwindled. and they wanted a central government. a strong central government, the two big communities. But the British ensured that at independence we had a federal constitution. They ensured we had a federal constitution. But the big community said, fine, give us that federal constitution, let's get political independence, and we will show you a thing or two. And within a year, they had destroyed the federal constitution. They had weakened the federal units, and they had changed the parliamentary system into a presidential system, where Jomo Kenyatta metamorphosized from a prime minister to a president. And when we were working on our new constitution, beginning with the agitation for the return of multi-party politics, the noises about federalism came back. And I'm not using noises in a negative way. But again, the big communities managed to ensure that instead of federalism, we got devolution. 47 units called counties were introduced. But the smaller communities have not got, the federal state that they are looking for. Now we also have the Somali and coastal secessionist aspirations. The coast, as I've already said, was not really part of what we now call Kenya. It was under the Sultan of Zanzibar, but leased to the British. And at independence, it was handed over to Kenya. But because of marginalization, the coastal peoples are feeling they are not being recognized and they are not being given a fair share of the country's resources. Some people have been saying, let's have a state of our own. The Somali, sorry for doing it in reverse order, the Somali, they have a very sad history because they were split up into very many countries. There are Somalis in Kenya, in Ethiopia, in Somalia, in Djibouti. I mean, they are all over. And for a long time, they kept hoping one day they could have their own Somali state. And so they used to talk a lot about secession, but since the breakdown of the Somali state, we don't hear a lot about that story now. But it is somewhere in their heart. We wish Somalia would stabilize, and we wish we could join it, because their culture is pretty different from most of the other cultures. Then we have the efforts of national minorities to ensure that they enjoy all the privileges of citizenship. We are talking of the Europeans, the Asians who came to build the railway. We are talking about the Nubians who came as mercenaries to fight for the British to conquer the country. And when the British left, they did not make proper arrangements for the Nubians. And now the Kenyan government is dragging its feet about recognizing them as full citizens. So they find it very difficult to get passports, for example. And where they came from Southern Sudan. Obviously, Southern Sudan does not know them anymore. They have been away for over 100 years. So they titter at the brink of statelessness. And then you have the struggle of pastoralists and hunter-gatherers to protect their culture and natural resources against encroachment by agriculturalists and industrialists. You see, the pastoralists have had their lands taken first by the European colonialists. And when independence came and the lands were being given back to the Kenyan government, they were not going back to those who used to own them. The KANU government came up with a story they called willing buyer, willing seller. And so you find people from other parts of Kenya buying lands that were initially Kalenjin lands or Maasai lands. And it is a point of bitterness. And then you have the hunter-gatherers. These are the most oppressed, because they are actually oppressed by the pastoralists who have themselves been oppressed. And the hunter-gatherers are people who used to live in the forests, live a very simple, they had a very simple economy, hunting game, wild animals, and collecting honey. And then the government comes after independence and says, get out of these forests, you are destroying the forest. Question is, how come those forests never got destroyed for the hundreds of years that they were in those forests? The truth is, it is the modern capitalistic loggers who come and log, take away wood from the forest. The hunter-gatherers never did that. They didn't have a wood industry. Actually, they preserved the environment. But now they have been thrown out, and a lot of them have had to actually try and become farmers or pastoralists, and it's a totally new thing. Their forefathers did not engage in such things. And then you have the struggle of ethnic minorities generally for adequate representation. They keep wanting to see that they are better represented in parliament. And now we have parliament at the central level, and we also have parliament at the county levels. And they are trying to find ways to get their voices heard in that environment. Well, why is it that these groups are so ignored? Because of a simple phenomenon which I call politicized ethnicity. Now, politicized ethnicity, or ethnicized politics, is the mobilization of sections of the population on the basis of cultural identities with a view to capturing or retaining state power. So when an election comes, if I'm a Luo politician and I'm standing for the presidency, I tell the Luo people, we need to get this seat. We, the Luo, need to get it. And the Kikuyu candidate goes and tells fellow Kikuyus, we should get this seat. And both of them are arousing or stirring the ethnic loyalty, using it as a vehicle to get state power. This is what I'm calling, and it's not my original term, I found it in the literature, politicized ethnicity. Now, what are the causes of politicized ethnicity? One of them is the absence of a single disproportionately large Kenyan ethnic group. You see, because each of the groups is in a sense disadvantaged by itself, you would think that would promote cooperation. But the reasoning of the politician is simple. I must first get a solid following from my own people, then use them at the bargaining table to get somebody from another ethnic group to cooperate with me. Because if I don't do that, I'll never get power. At least if there was a group which was 50% or more, they would not need to whip up ethnic sentiment too loudly in one sense. They might feel secure, I have the numbers. Not that politicized ethnicity would be absent, but it would not get to the high pitch to which it gets to. It would not be as feverish as it is. The second cause is the relative equality of the five major ethnic groups. Actually, this second is very related to the first. If I was to redo these slides, I would join the two and say that the relative equality of the five major ethnic groups, Kikuyu, Luhya, Kalenjin, Luo, and Kamba, ensures that a politician must first solidify the following in his ethnic group and use those numbers to negotiate. Then you have the third, the existence of many small groups whose combined share of the country's population is I don't say under, you correct that to about 14%. And they too feel that, hey, we are always disadvantaged. As groups, we must do something to get power. And fourthly, the sense of kinship among members of individual ethnic groups. Now that should, in future, in my future slide, perhaps be number one. incidentally, I make these slides myself. When I come back to Vienna, I've learned how to put photos there as well. But for now, I'll live with the text. Now, what I'm saying is this. The sense of kinship among members of individual ethnic groups is what causes politicized ethnicity to flourish. Let me explain. African peoples think in terms of family. Life is about kinship. Kinship is through marriage or through blood. I am related to so and so because he has married our daughter. And our daughter here is a term that doesn't mean the nucleus family, father, mother, and children. It could be my second cousin's daughter, but that's still our daughter. And and the other man has married our daughter, so he's our relative. Kinship is also through blood, that we all we come from the same ancestor. So we have a connection through blood. Now, we need to understand that the African family is the idea about mother, father, and children as family is really foreign to the African thinking. Family can't be that small. Family is much bigger than that. My father and my mother, my wife, my son, they're all part of the family. I'm sure you, even in your situation, that is the case, but it is louder, I think, in our situation. And now, from the nucleus family, mother, father, children, you then get a cluster. I mean, my brother and his wife and children, and my other brother and his wife and children, and my sister. And now, then, you have several of these forming a clan. The clan is a group of people who believe they are descended from the same person. And then several clans form the ethnic group. Now, the ethnic group again claims to descend from one person. Like among the Kikuyu, they have their ancestor called Gikuyu and his wife Mumbi. Among the Luo, you have Ramogi. And if all Luos are descended from Ramogi, then they are all brothers and sisters. And if one of them then stands for elections as president, then our brother is standing for elections. This is what really stirs up politicized ethnicity. And it no longer matters whether he has good policies or bad policies, he is our brother. And how dare you oppose your brother? Now, I want to look briefly at how politicized ethnicity has grown from the dawn of the Kenyan state. During the colonial era, there was divide and rule. The colonialists ensured that there was suspicion among the various ethnic groups. The classic example is that between the Kikuyu and the Luo. The Kikuyu and the Luo are not neighbors. They have no good reason to quarrel. They have no common boundary, so neither of them can say you have encroached onto my land. If the Luo and the Kipsigis were hostile to one another, it would be understandable. They share a border, and for many years there were cattle raids across that border. We even have stories about it. So where did the hostility between the Kikuyu and the Luo come from? It came from the British. go, then the British go to the Kikuyu and tell the Kikuyu the Luos are lazy. And then they come to the Luo and tell the Luo, oh, the Kikuyus are thieves. And that kind of stereotype then works itself into the thinking of the population. And there were other strategies for divide and rule, but in the interest of time, let me not go there. You then have Jomo Kenyatta coming to power as the first president. And with him, you have the dominance of the Kikuyu elite. A few people who really wielded power. We had people like Mbiu Koinange, who was his brother-in-law and was Minister of State. And then you had Njoroge Mungai and Charles Njonjo, and on the list goes. Then you have Daniel Arap Moi, and suddenly you have the dominance of Kalenjin elite. Now out goes the Njoroge Mungais, the Kikuyus, and in comes the Franklin Betts, the Abraham Tunoi, and all those. Then you come to the Mwai Kibaki regime, and you have the return of Jomo Kenyatta's Kikuyu inner circle. At first, it looked like that would not happen, because Kibaki was actually standing against Uhuru Kenyatta. And so people thought, ha, that is his great competitor. There is no way they can work together. But by the end of his presidency, he loudly declares that Uhuru is the best suited to take over from him. This is not personal, just politics. Now, then you have Uhuru Kenyatta. And of course, this is the son of Jomo Kenyatta. So I've not talked about the Kenyatta-Jomo elite still there. But one thing that is happening now is a struggle for dominance between Kikuyu and Kalenjin elite. Well, the big question is, we have only been talking of Kikuyu, Kalenjin elite. Where are all the other ethnic groups? What are they thinking about all of this? At least these two are jostling for power because they are near it. What are the others supposed to do? Now, I want to talk about the impact of politicized ethnicity. It has had several effects on our politics. One of them, disparity in development between and among various regions of the country. The regions that have had a president are much more developed economically than regions that have never had a president come from there. Now, if you take Kiambu, for example, Kiambu County, the doctor-to-patient ratio that I saw is impressive. Go to Turkana, the county of people who have never moved anywhere near the presidency. And you have this large expanse of land full of poverty, and every year it needs good aid. And recently oil and water was discovered there. So people are getting interested, but not for the Turkanas, for the oil and the water. Then you have the stunting of the growth of issue-based politics as ethnic personality cults have taken center stage. During elections, each candidate has a manifesto. He talks about health, he talks about creating jobs, but we know, if you are a Kenyan, you know, those are just things being talked about to show that they have a national, they have a serious vision for the country. But in reality, those are not the issues. The issue is ethnicity. And then you have violent inter-ethnic conflicts. These have been there since the dawn of independence. We had clashes between the Kalenjin and other communities in the Rift Valley. In 1992, 1997, we had elections. We had similar situations. Then in 2002, we didn't have much of that, and the election, the transition was wonderful, and people said Kenya is going places. But come 2007, and Kenya almost sank into the abyss. And then you have people from ethnic minorities and mixed marriages are disadvantaged with regard to business and job opportunities. Let me say this. There are people, the mother may be a Kikuyu, the father is a Luo, and these two are supposed to be enemies, the communities, but strange, wonders, they often fall in love. So what is there? Where is the enmity? But now, in times of crisis, like we had in 2007, they're embarrassed to be together. They're under pressure. Why are you people together and those are our enemies? And then you have people, for example, who will find it very hard to get jobs. My neighbor is a Nubian. Let me talk about my neighbor Adam Hussein. He is a Nubian. And there was a time he was working in a company, and the company was restructuring, and there was the issue of people being moved to other sections or being laid off. And he was not being moved to another section, and he went to his boss and asked his boss, "Why am I not being given an opportunity?" He was told, "You have a name that cannot help to place you. You are not Onyango, you are not Njoroge, you are Adam Hussein." I mean, how, where do we place that? At least Njoroge is Kikuyu, Onyango is Luo. So if you are any of those, the bosses in the company who come from your community will try and work out something for you. But now you have this name that there is nobody in the company wielding influence who comes from your area. And then there was this case of during the clashes in 2007, there was a girl who has a Taita parent and a Luhya parent. And there were these young people who were stopping people and asking them, "What ethnic group do you belong to? And if you are a Kikuyu and the youth are Luo, they want to kill you." Now, this girl said, "I am Luhya." So he was told, "Speak some Luhya words." She was told, "Speak some Luhya words." And she couldn't, because although her mother is Luhya, I think it's her father who is Luhya and her mother is Taita, they lived in central Kenya. The only local language she knows is Kikuyu. In fact, if they had known that, because this particular crowd was an anti-Kikuyu crowd, they would have killed her. So they find themselves in a very awkward place. And now we come to why I really came to Vienna. I want to propose to you that liberal democracy is the one thing that Europe has bequeathed to Africa that has really caused us trouble. It is not appropriate for our situation. Liberal democracy is individualistic, but African peoples are communalistic. Traditional Western liberal democracy assumes that the political actors in a democracy are individuals with no fixed allegiance to a group of other individuals. However, Africans have a communalistic outlook based on kinship, and this results in political choices based on the interests of their ethnic groups. So you keep telling an African, "Go to the poll and choose the best candidate." And lo and behold, each time he goes to the poll, the best candidate must be the candidate from his ethnic group. Then the Western media says, the Africans are backwards. They are always choosing people according to their ethnic group. And we are saying, not necessarily, that is not backwardness. That is a cultural mode of thinking, and there is absolutely nothing wrong with it. What is wrong is a system of government forced on the African peoples. It is like me going to the tailor to get a suit. And this is not an original example at all. At one point, John Stuart Mill used it on Liberty. You go to a tailor to make your suit. He makes a suit. You come back. You try the suit, and it is too small. So the tailor says to you, because the suit is too small, let us cut you up and reduce some of the flesh on you so that you can fit into the suit. Excuse me, and children, what we need to adjust is the suit, not the man or woman. And this liberal democratic suit does not fit us. That is the point that I am saying, that I have come to make here, and see what you make of it. Liberal democracy arose out of the West's unique socio-economic experience. You know how liberal democracy developed? Of course, you have the ancient Greeks, and you know how Aristotle is associated with the statement that man is a rational being. Immanuel Kant takes over this idea and says, because man is a rational being, he is an end in himself. He must be treated with dignity. What does it say? In every case, treat yourself or any other person always as an end, never as a mere means. I'm sure you know more about that than I do. You know it in Kant's mother tongue, because it is your mother tongue, some of you. So that idea, and then Rousseau comes and says, the will of the people. And John Stuart Mill comes and says, the individual must be protected against the tyranny of the majority. And then John Rawls comes along and says, there are two principles that will ensure you have a just society. The principle of equal liberty for all, with the liberty of each individual limited only to the extent that his liberty interferes with other people's liberty. And the second principle, the principle of difference, that what should govern difference in the economic sphere, some have more, some have less, is that the difference there should still ensure that the most vulnerable in society benefit from that difference. And John Rawls then says, those two principles are enough for justice. In my doctoral work, which was published by Lambert Academic Publishing in Germany, they print on order. My doctoral work, I propose a third principle to add to John Rawls too. First, I join Odera Oruka in proposing that the order of the principles be reversed, so that economic rights are put before freedom. Because if you talk about freedom, but somebody is hungry, and you tell him you have freedom to choose the politician whom you think will lead the country best, and he is very hungry, the politician will come and give him a few Kenyan shillings to buy 1 kilo of sugar, and he take that vote away. What kind of use is that kind of freedom? And so we reversed the order. Odera did before me, and I followed him in that. And then I added the principle of the recognition and protection of ethnic minorities. Because liberal democracy has failed us. And so I am saying, consequently, condemnation of the African ethnocentric approach to politics is a manifestation of the imposition of the Western outlook on the politics of independent African countries. I am saying Liberal democracy has been forced on Africa. At independence, it was given to us, forced on us. But even when we started making the second generation of constitutions, now we could say we imposed it on ourselves. But you see, the people who were doing the writing were people who had gone right through Western type education, and it was extremely difficult for them to think beyond the debate, shall we have a presidential system, shall we have a parliamentary system? The truth is, those are not the only options. Just as Western democracies draw from their traditional institutions, such as the monarchy, African countries must formulate their own models of democracy, different from liberal democracy and catering for the communalistic outlook of the African masses. I happen to study philosophy, and in philosophy, we like to talk about essence versus accident. Accident, whether you are tall, short, fat or slim, is accidental to your being human. Something similar is true of democracy. A democracy can be liberal or it can be communalistic, but still be democracy. The important thing is participation of citizenry, and to ensure that their input is respected and that their input influences policy direction. If we don't understand that, then we will judge Africa always according to, are there elections every 5 years? Okay, is it by secret ballot? Are there many parties? Okay, that's a democracy. Please. I think some of those may be accidental. And so, a number of African thinkers, social theorists, are starting to wonder, can't we draw from our own indigenous political systems and come up with models of democracy that suit us? Let me ask you, is Britain a democracy? Britain. Is it a democracy? I tend to like when my audience responds. Is it a democracy?
We're not sure anymore since Maggie Thatcher, are we?
Pardon?
We're not sure anymore since Maggie Thatcher, are we?
Aha, you're not sure anymore. But even before you go to Maggie Thatcher, who elected Her Majesty the Queen? Her Majesty the Queen is Her Majesty the Queen through a process she wasn't even responsible for. She was born, that's all, and she didn't have anything to do with it. She couldn't have campaigned for it because it's just who gave birth to her. She is the Queen. And the other day, a child was born, and everybody is excited. A child has been born in the royal family. As though children don't get born every day. Who cares? I find it ridiculous that a family gobbles up your taxes, lives large at your expense, and feels very nice about it, and finally when a baby comes out of the whole process, you're also excited. One more person to gobble up our taxes. I find that difficult. Personally, that is my problem. And you never doubt that Britain is a democracy, because they have that traditional institution. It's an extremely traditional, some would even say archaic institution. It is there in the British political structure, and even the head of state, Her Majesty the Queen, is not elected, but Britain is supposed to be a democracy.
But you come to Africa and we are told, forget about thinking traditionally. You're supposed to understand modernity has now come. So stop thinking traditionally. Just embrace liberal democracy and move on. I just want to end with a quotation from a sociologist, a social scientist, an African social scientist called Aki, A-K-E. And he is concerned about the same matter that I'm concerned about. There seems to be a number of scholars who are now speaking louder and louder about this. And he is commenting on the whole issue of ethnicity and how the West tells us, stop tribalism. By the way, why should the Luo be called a tribe, but the Germans a nation? How about thinking about the German tribe, and the English tribe, and the French tribe, and the Italian tribe? What makes the Luo and the Kikuyu tribe, but the German and the English nations? These are all categories that are arbitrary, and they do represent a generous measure of bias. But let me read this quotation from Ake and rest my case so that we can go into a discussion. And if I have annoyed you, I have achieved my goal. If I have made you very happy, I have achieved my goal. But if I have only produced, oh, I see, I have failed. Now, here we go. Ethnicity supposedly epitomizes backwardness and constrains the development of Africa. This presupposition is misleading, however, for it is development rather than the people and their culture which has to be problematized. Development has to begin by taking people and their culture as they are, not as they might be, and proceeding from there to define the problems and strategies for development. Otherwise, the problematic of development becomes a tautology. The people are not and cannot be a problem just by being what they are, even if part of what they are is ethnic consciousness. Our treatment of ethnicity and ethnic consciousness reflects this tendency to problematize the people and their culture, an error that continues to push Africa deeper into confusion. The point, of course, is not to romanticize the past and be captive to it, but to recognize what is on the ground and strive to engineer a more efficient, less traumatic, and less self-destructive social transformation. Thank you. Thank you.